What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Fredita!
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic or Rockfin, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate the support. We couldn't do this without the amazing help of our sponsors, Honey Colony. We've had Miriam Hinnane on the show before. She's the founder of Honey Colony and the director of Vanishing of the Bees, and they've got a great store with all kinds of things, facial care, body care, gifts, home and garden, immune system boosts, lifestyle, sexual related stuff. I mean, they've got all kinds of things here. You might as well check it out. I mean, if you're in the market for some items for a spouse and you've given them the same thing from Bed Bath & Beyond every single year and they're tired of it, well, let's mix it up a little bit. Go check out honeycolony.com. Use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money and support a small business at the same time. Somebody that has been on the show. And our other sponsor is Chemical Free Body. Much like Honey Colony, we've had Tim James on the show several times. He's a small business owner. He is a fighter for truth and liberty, and he has his own company called Chemical Free Body, which makes outstanding products. You can get the Green 85 formula, which will do a number on you, man. It's really good for you. Gut detox, toxin detox. I bought packets of both of those and gave those to my father-in-law's. And actually even my wife this Christmas. So they make great presents. You can check out their products. You can sign up for his coaching even. They have classes, all kinds of things. Chemicalfreebody.com, promo code is also macro. Same thing. Save some money, support small businesses that are aligned in thinking. They are pushing for truth and freedom, and they are building products and selling products that match our level of determination in giving you high quality goods at a reasonable price. And I'll tell you what, it's so stressful this time right now. We've gone through holidays, we've had elections, we've had civil unrest, we've had insanity, and I love talking about all this and breaking it down, and it's needed and necessary and has a purpose. But from time to time, I like to take things a little bit less seriously and get into some alternative or more, a little bit more interesting type of topics. And so in order to do that, I brought in the one guy that I know knows this stuff inside and out. It's Midnight Mike, of course, from OBDM. What's going on, Mike? How are you? Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for inviting me on the show. I don't know if I know these topics inside and out.
Listen, you know these topics inside and out, goddammit.
Fair enough. I'm a goddamn expert.
And Mike and I represent one half of the founding crew of the Union of the Unwanted. So if you're unfamiliar with that show, that's a group podcast that we do twice a month with Sam Tripoli from Tinfoil Hat and Ricky Verandas from The Ripple Effect. And we invite on all sorts of interesting content creators and professionals in a variety of fields to have a roundtable discussion, talk about some of these problems and work it all out. Mike is the man who runs the technology side of this to help make sure that we get this information out. And the last episode that we did for the Union of the Unwanted was one of my favorites, actually. It was a suggestion of yours, which was the UFO discussion. And I love this stuff. I don't pretend to have it all figured out or have any sort of special top secret clearance or have some sort of sources on the inside. I don't know any of that. I don't have any of that. I just like it. I just think it's interesting and fascinating to talk about, as well as all of the cryptids and the things like that. And OBDM, man, I love, first of all, I have a podcast, obviously you're watching or listening to it currently, but my favorite podcast is OBDM and I've got Mike here from it. So we're going to geek out, or I'm going to geek out at least. And we're going to talk about Bigfoot. We're going to talk about chupacabras. We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. So, I know how I got into this stuff. I know how I developed this interest for it, but I'm curious how other people did. Was this from like comic books world that sort of migrated into it? Is it science fiction movies? Like, how did you develop this taste for the unusual?
I don't know exactly when it happened. It happened fairly early on in my life. I was living at my first house. So I was probably 5, 6, or 7. And I remember, you know, just drawing UFOs as a kid and handing those pictures to my mother. She probably threw them out or put them on the fridge. I don't remember. But I've been obsessed with the topics at a very young age. And, you know, I would see those commercials on TV. Time Life Magazines presents Mysteries of the Unknown or Creatures from Beyond. And I was obsessed with those books. And I probably got a few as a kid. That kind of died out between the ages of like 10 to 13. But I got heavily invested in Dungeons and Dragons, role-playing games like that, tabletop role-playing games. And then my interest got re-sparked when my mom gave me a book for one of my birthdays. It was the day after Roswell, read the book. And then I was a teenager at that point, and I didn't stop. Like, I would read like something almost every year, a couple of books a year on UFOs. And a lot of people consider these topics to be silly. And I do too, because some of these things that we will bring up are so far-fetched that it is hard to believe. And it's fun to goof on. I do that all the time. But more and more, I take it serious. I take my goofing around very seriously.
Of course you do.
I think that there is... between all the eyewitness testimony and affidavits and reports, I think there's a lot to this stuff. And over the years, like at least in recent history, when it comes to specifically UFO sightings, it was blown off. It was blown off decade after decade. Eyewitness reports that people were called. They said the evidence was baseless and that all these reports had no merit and there was no proof. And so nothing got done. There was no official investigation, but we know behind the scenes that wasn't the case, ranging from Project Grudge to Bluebeam to Project Sign and up until 2017 in December, where the Pentagon decided to funnel out a video of some interesting footage of a Navy pilot right next to the USS Nimitz. And here we are, somewhere in the middle of UFO disclosure. But that's just talking about nuts and bolts aliens, possibly. Yeah. There's nothing into on-the-ground humanoids and Bigfoots and anything like that. People aren't ready to talk about that. They're ready to talk about possible alien technology, but there's not even a lot of excitement about that. They're too busy calling for violence against their fellow citizens.
Right. Bigfoot, we need Bigfoot 2024. To bring back peace and order to the galaxy.
If there's anyone that can divert attention away from political drama, it could be Bigfoot or a series of gray aliens.
Yes.
That's the only thing, really. Think about how focused people are right now on headline news and politics and riots and protesting. What is more powerful than that? It would be a world event that diverts attention away to get everyone unified again. But we're not completely broken down yet.
No. Now, I remember being like a real little kid, like maybe five or six, and I'm old. So this was the late 70s. I remember watching In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, and that his voice, you know, and the sort of poor quality, recording made it kind of like a wobbly, you know, when he's talking, and very, very old and creepy. And I remember watching an episode about a, I don't know if it was a guy by himself or if it was a pair of people that were in this house. It was out in the middle of nowhere, and they were awoken in the middle of the night with sounds of things hitting the house, and they didn't know what it was, and they ran outside, and there was a Bigfoot throwing rocks at their house, at the house where they were in. And I remember this like it was yesterday. And I was telling Tony Merkel about this too, who does the confessionals, which is a Bigfoot thing. And I was just throwing it out. He goes, "Oh, it's this case and so, that's a real famous one." I was like, "Oh, really? Is it? I'm not imagining this, something from like 40 years ago." He's like, no, man, that's how I first remember learning about anything unusual like that was Bigfoot. That was number one. And as a kid, fascinating. Tall ape doing that. Second time I had any sort of experience with this was when I was 8 years old and I went on a summer trip to British Columbia. And we were in a motorhome. We went by this lake, and there's a like a Loch Ness monster type creature that lives in this lake called Onopogo. And I was like, whoa, did these things exist? And you know, and there was T-shirts of it. I mean, so who knows if it really exists? But this was when I first, as a kid, got into that. Now, I didn't take a deep dive or anything, but it first kind of got on my radar that there are things out there that are really fascinating, and there's questions about whether or not they actually exist because they're so rare.
That like In Search Of was big too. But Unsolved Mysteries, that
Unsolved
was
Mysteries, yeah.
Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack. I mean, I would watch that every week with my brother. And I was lucky enough to have like a mother who was open to these topics and it still is. So, I mean, those conversations were had, but it wasn't taken as seriously as it is now. And, you know, when you're a 12-year-old kid, you ask mom about Bigfoot, she's going to say, "We don't know," you know?
Yeah. Has anything changed, though? Do we know? Do we still not know?
We might know more now than we did in the 80s. But it depends on what side of the Bigfoot wall you're on. I mean, with every community, it seems like there's zealots and it's fractured. The Bigfoot community has, it's a North American ape-like primate. And then there's another group of people that says, no, it is an ancestor of man, and it has a DNA structure that is very similar to man, and that it's unless you do a particular type of DNA test, you're not going to figure out it has a different type of mother. It's like some sort of like giant man offspring. Mm. Those two communities in the Bigfoot community, they don't like each other, and they will actively try to undermine each other's theories when we're all just looking for some answers here, and it's tough to get them together.
You ever had any sort of encounter, any sort of anything, and know anybody I'm sure you do because you've had people on the show, but
No one personally that I know of has had any sort of cryptid encounter. I've had paranormal experiences, like mostly probably poltergeist or some sort of haunting, but not a creature per se. I don't know what I would do if I had that experience. I would probably try to film something. And here in Ohio, especially where I live in the woods, there is the Ohio grass man, which is our version of a Bigfoot type creature. Ohio has a ton of stuff. It's got a ton of different cryptids, and you know, we're close to Kentucky, which has the Kentucky goblins, and we're not that far away from Point Pleasant, which is the home of the Mothman, and just 3 hours away from Pennsylvania, which has the, one of the biggest UFO and Bigfoot flaps from the 60s and 70s, as documented by Stan Gordon in the book Silent Invasion. Just incredible. Like, but you get all these kinds of stories, no matter what state you're in. Mm-hmm. If you look hard enough, they each have their own folklore and history with these cryptids.
Yeah. So is that accidental? Is the, or are we talking about a theme here? There's got to be a pattern at which, you know, that it, if everybody, you know, culturally, not even just state by state, but culture by culture, they're telling the same story. They've got different names for it. They've got Yeti. They've got, you know, forget what the Australians call their version of it.
I know what you're talking about.
Yowie or something like that.
You've
got all these different names for apparently the same sort of thing out there. I mean, at some point, maybe we connect the dots and say, it's there, or at least it was there somewhere, because it's found its way into cultural legend in a way that seems almost impossible for this to happen, you know, for every culture across oceans to have their own story about a larger than human ape-sized creature that walks upright and is very elusive, hard to find, but people that have had encounters with it swear on their lives that it was as real as anything else they've seen out there. So it's there has to be something to it, right?
I would imagine so. And it goes beyond Bigfoot and people seeing similar types of ape-like creatures in different continents. On my previous show, I did a segment on people seeing weird little dwarf-like creatures throughout time, starting back in the early Dark Ages and then going up until the 1940s of people seeing dwarves, oftentimes dressed in a uniform, something that was a skin-tight uniform, sometimes with helmets and goggles, oftentimes in a set of three, that looked like they were showing up because they're all wearing like a certain uniform. You'd imagine that they have some sort of job to do. And just as quickly as they show up and startle a human, the human turns around to tell somebody and they turn back around and they're gone. There's reports from them finding a dwarf like in a river. They try to bring it in, socialize it, you know, put it in church to try to Christianize it. None of that works. And so they chain it to a basement only to find that it's escaped under a rock. And I just find those little tidbits, it goes deeper into cryptozoological stuff. Fascinating, because someone documented it throughout time and it was a real experience. Now, they could have just encountered a little person and that was their interaction with a little person. But some of these descriptions are just so far-fetched that it wouldn't just be a human little person wearing a suit with a couple of his buddies terrorizing people who are hanging up their laundry. It goes a little deeper than that. And I actually have like five different stories here that are off the beaten path kind of stuff.
Yes.
These are like stuff that you don't really hear too often. And when you're talking about commonalities, I look for those patterns of different people experiencing similar things, then these people probably don't have any relation or knowledge of one another, but they're experiencing a similar thing. This first one is from Illinois, and it's in August 1944. And this is from Mattoon. So there's a Mattoon resident. He awoke feeling very ill. He got out of bed, kind of shakily made his way to a bed or the bathroom where he was sick. Yeah, he told his wife that he was sick and that she blamed her because maybe she left the gas on. And she said, I don't think I did that, but I'll check. And to her complete bewilderment, she tried to get up and get out of bed, but she found that she was paralyzed too. She was intoxicated or paralyzed with something. Shortly afterwards, a housewife down in the other part of the town, she awoke to the sounds of her young daughter coughing. And when she got up, she found that she strangely could barely walk too. The next evening, Mrs. Ben Kinnery, while sleeping in her bedroom, she shared with her 3-year-old daughter, Dorothy, who stirred from her slumber by a particular smell, She first noticed a sickening, sweet odor in the bedroom. She later told a local reporter, but at the time, I thought it was just from the flowers outside the window. But the odor grew stronger, and she became more paralyzed with each whiff of this odor, to where her lower legs, her lower body was no longer working, and she decided to scream out. So upon that scream, that got the neighbors going, and they searched the yards, the entire neighborhood, and no one could pinpoint the source of this strange smell. The police were called in. They searched around. They couldn't find anything as well. But upon returning to her home, Mrs. Kinnery said she caught the fleeting glimpse of a man standing outside one of the windows. He was tall, dressed in dark clothing, and wearing a tight-fitting cap, which is bizarre. By September 5th, this took place in August, the police had received four more reports of gas attacks, all within the vicinity, claiming people noticed a sickly, sweet, odorous smell before becoming nauseated, paralyzing them for 30 to 90 minutes. According to news accounts, on September 5th, the police checked and what they thought might be a hideout for the anesthetic, they called it the anesthetic prowler, but found nothing that bore any theory, and they couldn't prove it out. However, that same evening, another person was presented to the police that they had concrete evidence of the gasser's existence. But when her and her husband had returned home that evening, they discovered that a white cloth had been placed on their porch. She picked it up, noticing that it was wet and it had a scent to it. She smelled it and she passed out and became nauseated, and nothing worked below the waist at that point. And so the police decided to investigate that one. They showed up and the police found a skeleton key and an empty lipstick tube on the porch where she had picked up the cloth. The same night, another housewife heard someone at her bedroom window before she could act out. The gas seeped into her room, rendering her paralyzed for several minutes. And those are the accounts of that. Who was the guy in the tight-fitting cap wearing dark clothing? No one knows. The police couldn't track him down. So you could just say that was maybe some prowler that was gassing people.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I don't know how easy it is to gas people in 1944 like that. But that kind of, that paralysis, that gas paralysis is not uncommon in UFO encrypted encounters. I talked about an encounter a few months ago. Donald Shrum, he was out hunting with his friends in California in the mid-60s. He got separated from his group, and he swears that while he treed himself overnight to avoid being eaten by predators, that he saw UFO land down. He saw a couple of humanoids exit the UFO, and they are wearing skin-tight outfits. They approached his tree. They tried to shake him out of it. They couldn't get him down, so they called in two robots. This is what he said. They called in two robots, and those robots released a gas substance that he said made him nauseated, causing him to vomit and convulse, get sleepy and pass out, and then wake up again. And they repeatedly gassed him over the course of the night while he tried to defend himself. Doesn't sound unlike what these people in Illinois experienced of waking up, being nauseated, and being paralyzed in some fashion. I don't know if there's any correlation, but there is a similarity to that.
Well, I'll tell you a story that really freaked me out. I have family friends. They're friends of my ex-wife. They're actually related to my ex-wife through marriage. And they stopped over at our house in Las Vegas years and years ago. and they were driving from LA to Colorado. So they stopped in Vegas, stayed with us overnight, and then they were going to head out the next morning. So we had dinner, and they said, "Oh, well, we're gonna the husband was like, "Oh, I'm going to go down to the wine store. I'm going to get you guys some good bottles of wine, start your wine collection." I was like, "Okay, whatever. I don't even really drink, but that's fine." So he got a bunch of wine and we had dinner and we were all drinking that night. The wife is kind of like hippie-ish a little bit. And I knew that she had some kind of alternative beliefs based on her childhood of growing up. And it turned out that during the course of this dinner, she explained what had happened. When she was a kid, she and her sisters would see UFO experiences from time to time, to the point where it wasn't that surprising to her. And it continued throughout her whole life. Now, the time I'm having this conversation with her, I'm saying she's probably late 50s at this point, right? And the husband, they're both very well educated, have very serious jobs in real estate. They're like running like real estate funds and everything. I mean, hardcore, no nonsense type of people. Like the husband kind of is so much of like a Republican guy. You know, you kind of look at Mike Pence. This is like a Mike Pence type guy. No nonsense, okay. No bullshit, no nothing, right? She's telling the story about how back at their house, one time in the middle of the night, they both woke up and there was a gray alien at the foot of their bed. Now, she talks about this and I go, okay, whatever. But he confirmed the story because he was in the bed as well. And he said, you know, I kind of wake up. I don't know why I woke up. Maybe I woke up because she woke up, but he's like, I woke up and there was exactly as you would, you know, as you've seen in the movies, a gray alien standing at the foot of the bed. And he says, I'm thinking about this going, what am I seeing here? Is this real? Am I still asleep? Am I awake? And before he had a chance to get up and do anything, I don't know if it put a finger or his hand, it touched his foot. And he said he just was frozen. He said, I imagine that's what it's like when someone's having a heart attack, because everything stopped and I couldn't move anywhere. I couldn't move. I couldn't make a noise. I felt like I couldn't even breathe. I just was stuck there and I was watching this happen and I couldn't do anything about it. And we're looking at each other going, holy shit, you know, is this for real? Like if she was telling, you know, if the wife was telling the story, I would still listen and still be interested and still probably believe it to a certain extent. But for some reason, he confirmed it. And what did it for me was the fact that he was the least likely guy to ever talk about something like that, because he's a serious businessman guy with a real, you know, hardcore job that raises millions of dollars from investors. And like the idea of him being potentially unhinged might be a detriment. But he sat there right across from me and said, listen, I'm telling you, it happened to me. It happened to me. It just didn't happen to a friend. It's not a story. He's like, that damn thing put its hand on me and I thought I was dying. And then I go, well, what happened? He says, when it was done, when they took its hand off, I came back and it was gone. I was like, what did you do? He says, well, I didn't sleep for a couple of days, you know, because I was freaked out. And so it was just interesting to hear.
Was there any sort of communication between, like, he didn't have communication with it. Was there any communication between it and his wife?
I don't remember. I don't remember that part of the story. I don't remember if there was any point to it, but I mean, to the encounter, but from her perspective, it wasn't terribly unusual for her. She didn't have the holy shit, what is happening to me sort of reaction that he had, because to him, this was my crazy wife talks about this, has been talking about this stuff for years and years. And I believe her, but maybe she's nuts. I don't know. And then it happened to him. And he's like, oh, he goes, I said, so do you believe her crazy stories now? He says, 100%.
What's the benefit for him to make that up?
Exactly. That was it. It was like there was no upside to him telling that story. He didn't admit it in front of other people. He admitted it in front of us, but we were technically like family by marriage. So it was, yeah. And I've met the wives. I've met her other sisters and have asked them about it too. And I said, oh yeah, we heard about a story. She goes, oh yeah. She says, yeah, our whole lives we've been sort of having these encounters. So, I mean, there's something, you know, we hear stories about that, how it's multi-generational or how it's tied to, or it happens to you when you're young and then it continues to happen to you throughout your whole life. Like maybe they're like what we do when we go out and tag animals with sensors and then track them over their lives to see where they migrate to and see what their behavior is like. And they're, you know, how maybe they're tracking us is, I mean, it's possible.
So, throughout all the stories that I've read, there was one, I'll briefly recount it, that there was a woman in New York who was suffering from these abductions. And she didn't know what to do about it. This is back in the 80s. And she was frightened. She thought there was something drastically wrong. Beyond the abduction being visited by these aliens, she thought there was some sort of misalignment spiritually, and she heard that she could fix this by visiting a shaman in Arizona, a shaman on a Native American reservation. So she made a trip to Arizona to go through this spirit journey. And when she met the shaman, she said, "Yes, I've heard of these entities, and they have a part of your soul, and you have to go there, and you have to visit them on their a realm of reality." And ask for it and bargain for your soul back. And so they go through this spirit journey, probably by taking some sort of hallucinogen, and they both go on this spirit journey. And they she recounts that they pretty much leave orbit through their astral bodies and board what they say is a spaceship, at which point in time they are interacting, both her and the shaman are bargaining for her soul back. And the aliens essentially say, you can't have it back. We made deals with you and your lineage that we are going to continue to do this and use your soul in your body because we have deals and we need it in order to keep on going. I guess at some point in time, the shaman was able to strike a deal that wasn't very specific in the book. They return back to their bodies, and the shaman wakes up and said, I have never seen that in all my years of doing astral journeys. This is a completely new thing for him. Like, the shaman didn't know what he was in for. Whoa. What do you attribute that to? It's a strange thing. There's a lot of people that claim and believe that these UFOs, these entities who occupy them, are demonic in nature. I don't know. Maybe that's just the religious connotation that we put towards something that is a little bit weird.
Well, there's certainly something there. Now, I know that we can have active imaginations. I know that we can go on psychedelic journeys. I've done that. It's, but I've always, even when I've had hardcore psychedelic trips, I've always known on some level that it was, that I was in the middle of a psychedelic trip. You know, that was the key thing, was that I didn't wake up in the middle of it confused as to what had happened. I knew what had happened. I knew why I was feeling as unusual as I was feeling. And I've heard stories about that. I've heard stories about people saying, you know, my roommate back right after college had a friend who said that he would tell people, like, I'll come get you tonight. Like, you can, I'll pop you out of your body and we'll go fly around. And everyone's like, no, first of all, most people are saying you're out of your mind. And second of all, if they actually did believe him, they would say, no, thank you. But there was a guy that, you know, this guy's telling me a story. He's like, yeah, you know, I got popped out of my body by this other dude and we went flying around. I go, wait a second. What do you mean flying around? He's like, I felt like me, but I wasn't in my body and I was flying. And I go, well, where were you flying? He says, I was flying around Santa Monica. And I was like, well, I don't know. In my head, I just envisioned that he would be flying. If he was flying, he was flying around some nondescript place, like rivers and streams and all this around nature and everything. It just surprised me that his answer was Santa Monica, of all the places to fly around. But maybe that's because he was from, you know, Los Angeles. But he's like, I was flying around Santa Monica. And I said, well, did you see anybody? He goes, no, it was like late. It was like late night, early dawn type thing. I said, well, so nobody was out there? Nobody saw you? He said, even if somebody was out there, they probably wouldn't see me. But he said, what was fascinating was that the birds could see him, and that the birds recognized that he was there.
And that's like, fascinating.
Whoa. Okay. So I have no way to confirm if any of that is true, except that once again, the guy telling the story is, you know, he's sincere in the story. So it's like, whether it's true or not, he believes the story, or he believed that it happened. So I don't know. I don't know. But that was my first sort of time I heard about like astral travel and things like that. And then you can meet people or read books and they're like, oh yeah, that stuff is real. But you know, look, if you haven't had it happen to you, then it's hard to really comprehend it. I can understand why people would think that was bullshit, but I also understand, probably like you do, which is that there's a world out there beyond our eyeballs and beyond the senses that we possess. And just because we don't think it's real, or we don't think it's possible because we're stuck in this meat suit of ours, that doesn't mean that it isn't possible. It just means that we haven't gotten to that point yet. And so it's interesting that, you know, when you just keep hearing the same story or the same variation of the story, not just through your culture, but other cultures or other times, you know, hundreds of years ago, or things start showing up in artwork and you're like, what is that? Why is that? Does that look like a UFO in the back of these paintings? And I don't know if people are monkeying with it in Photoshop or whatever, but it seems like we can't all be crazy, right?
I mean, if we are, then that's just a reality. We're all crazy at the same time. My wife had an astral projection out of body experience back in Phoenix about a year ago, maybe. Ooh. Where we were sleeping, and she said that she was dreaming and she was looking down at me and her, and she was like a little petrified. So she was scared and she was trying to reach over to wake me up, but she had no control over her body. And so she was like yelling at me, like in her astral body, for me to get up, but I wasn't moving. And I believe her, because my wife is very in touch with like meditation, mm-hmm. spiritual practices. Like she actively participates in that, and is more spiritually aligned than I am. She's much more practiced at that. And yeah. She swears to that, but she can't tell you. Like she didn't leave the room or anything like that. She was just like bewildered that she found herself out of her body and hovering over the two of us.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe there's something to that. You said, you mentioned your wife has a background in that meditation. Maybe you need to be physically or mentally, you need to be aligned in the right way for this to happen to you. Maybe you have to have that belief, even if it's not maybe it's just an unfounded belief, but a belief nonetheless that this is a possibility for you to have these sort of encounters. I remember like The Empire Strikes Back, where Luke is being trained by Yoda, and Yoda and the X-Wing goes underwater and Luke tries to bring it up and he can't. And then Yoda, you know, with one hand picks it up and puts it on the dry land. And he said, I don't believe it. And Yoda's response is, and that's why you fail. So maybe you have to have the belief first and be open to it before those experiences sort of come your way.
I think that's part of it. There are various instances where there's people who have no interest in the subject. They have no belief in the subject, and they still experience something that is incredible. You know, let me recount this one story, because this is the craziest story I've heard in a long time. And this is like from 1981 in Connecticut. It's about a guy named Frank. He's living in Connecticut. His wife was out of town. And so he's in his apartment, and then all of a sudden his his power goes out. His power is cut. And he tries to call the electric company, but when he picks up the phone, there's no dial tone. So he got a flashlight, looked around, notices all the power is still on in the rest of the neighborhood. So yeah, he checks everything. He comes back upstairs and he hears his phone ring for some reason. He picks it up and he hears, "Greetings. We are from another galaxy and we have chosen you to communicate with. Don't be alarmed. We mean you no harm, but we have neutralized the power in your home so we could speak with you." He tried talking back to this thing, but it was like he was talking back to a pre-recorded message. So that you're trying to talk to an answering machine. You're not going to get a response. They said, "Hey, just hold on here. Go to your television, sit down, and wait there." So Frank does that. He's like, whatever. Grabs a beer, goes and sits down in front of the television. Next thing you know, the television pops on with this humanoid-looking face on the television. It's kind of fuzzy, but he can make it out. That's a kind of like a human-like face, very large eyes that are almost wrapped around his head and very like a pear-shaped head. He couldn't see the mouth moving, but he said, "Hey, this is what it said. My name is Lomunk. I am projecting my image to you from my ship located beyond your moon. I come here from a race called the Ashtar, and we've been observing your planet for 10,000 years. We are making contact with individuals who have been genetically programmed to assist us in saving your planet." And so Frank was like, "What the hell? I don't want anything to do with this. This is BS. I don't want to help anybody. I don't consent to this." And so Frank picks up his beer bottle, smashes his TV, grabs some more liquor, downs it, passes out, and goes to sleep. And this obviously frightens him for the next few days. He doesn't know what to do. His wife comes home. She sees the TV's broken. So he kind of explains to her what's going on. So he doesn't really explain everything, but explains enough to his wife where his wife becomes concerned. Next thing you know, Frank is going out for a walk. And he passes out. He gets up and he sees people that are dressed in 1800s garb. And then he kind of passes out again. And next thing you know, he is being communicated with on a ship. And they tell him, and they said, "Hey, Frank, you are going to go back in time and defuse a bomb." And Frank says, "I don't know how to do that. defuse bombs. I'm not trained to do that. I don't know how to do that. And I don't agree to do any of this." And the alien says, "Yeah, you did agree to do this back when you were 12. And at that point in time, Frank remembers meeting a very strange person on the street asking for help. And Frank did agree to help. There was just no time frame put on that help." So, Lomunk, the alien, hands Frank a device, at which point it fuses with him in a certain way, and he gains all the knowledge needed to defuse a bomb. And when Frank asks him, like, "Hey, why don't you guys just do this? Why don't you guys defuse the bomb?" And they said, "We can't do it. We're not in this dimension. You're here in this dimension. It takes a lot of effort and energy for us to appear, and it's just easier if we get humans to do it for us." And so they give him all the knowledge to defuse this bomb. They give him the ability to travel back. I believe it was to the 1970s in Connecticut. They drop him off to defuse a bomb. He defuses it. And then they warp him back to the 80s. And he comes back. He shows up at his house and says to his wife, "Hey, I'm back." And the wife's like, "You've been gone for like 2 days." But according to Frank, he's only been gone for a few hours. At which point he explains to her the entire story, and she insists that he goes to therapy and never talk about this ever again.
Jesus. I mean, how do you have that conversation with your wife? You know? Honey,
I'm a time traveling bomb disposal guy.
Yeah, isn't this the plot for the next Star Wars?
It certainly could be. It could be the next Terminator plot.
Terminator 12. You're going back to the 70s in Connecticut.
It's just so such a bizarre story.
Yeah.
With like little weirdly specific. I mean, it could be a work of fiction. It could just be a fantastical story. It could be all that. I just find it to be so bizarre. It's some of those things. We got a ship, but it's cloaked on the far side of your moon. You know,
I've never been that high.
No, neither have I.
Maybe we're doing it wrong.
It's the wrong weed.
Maybe I need to get so baked that I feel like I've been taken to a spaceship. What have you ever had any UFO experiences?
I mean, the best one that I've had is when my wife and I got married. We got married out in Sedona, Arizona, and so out in Sedona, Arizona, they have like a lot of night vision UFO tours. I was going to say we went to a bachelor party, but there's no bachelor party before the wedding. It's a very small wedding, and so for our, I guess, the bachelor party the night before the wedding, we took ourselves and my family. And our families in general out there to do a UFO night vision tour. And you get these like Gen 3, Gen 4 night vision goggles on. You look up at the sky, you see every star imaginable. It's absolutely beautiful. And the person giving the tour gives you a rundown of what is an aircraft, what is an aircraft, what are the lights that are blinking, is it military? And we saw like lights moving across the sky that most likely were not satellites. And certainly lights that appear to be coming in from orbit and leaving our orbit. I saw a light in the sky. Who can tell how high up it was, but it was moving. The light was moving between like two stars and it stopped probably for a period of like 5 seconds. And then this decided to keep on going. Not an up close and personal UFO experience, but we all kind of saw stuff in the sky, lights moving around. That didn't move in conventional ways that our airplanes would, or they didn't move in ways that they signified with their lighting that they were military or anything like that. And some just moved or just left orbit.
Was Stephen Greer your counselor, your guide for this trip?
No. There was no meditation. There was no Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind meditation. This is all done through just night vision goggles and sky watching. No up close and personal stuff, though. Just stuff that was who knows how many miles away it was, but fascinating, man. Beautiful.
I'm gonna have to do that. My in-laws live there in Sedona, so I'll have an opportunity to check that out. I met a guy years ago. This was 95, a photographer, and I was doing work with him, and I had to go to his photography studio, and he said we were done with whatever we were doing, and we were just talking. It was he and his wife, and they had their own legit like warehouse studio, and he's saying we were coordinating about when I was going to pick this stuff up, when's this going to be done, when can I come back and get it. He goes, well, it'll probably be done in maybe a week. He's like, oh no, it'll probably be 2 weeks, because next week I've got this project that I got invited to do that is so crazy. And I was like, what? You know? And he said, it's nuts. He goes, I get this phone call from this guy who says, hello, this is Air Force Colonel so-and-so or whatever. We wanted to know if you would be available for a freelance project. We'd like to have you come to one of our facilities and film things, you know, and take pictures of everything for us. And he was like, sure, fine, whatever. It's at this secret test base or a test base that's not, you know, it was Area 51 was basically what he was being told, he was alluded to. And so this photographer saying to me, like, he goes, so they, you know, I'm talking to this colonel and he's asking me if I'm interested in this thing. He's like, yeah, sure. You know, they're offering, you know, the rate is good money and I'll do it. And it sounds interesting. Why wouldn't I? He goes, but what was weird was that when the guy ended the phone call, he said, this phone call did not take place and any record of it will not show up on your phone bills if you care to challenge that. So just so you know, and like hung up. He was like, that's okay. That's weird. And so we were really excited. I was like, well, I go, can I ask you like a really obvious question? And please don't take this the wrong way. You know, to the photographer, I go, like the Air Force doesn't have photographers that they can
use? They don't have staff photography
to take pictures of this. He goes, you don't think I'm thinking the same thing? I'm thinking the exact same thing. But he's like, hey, whatever. They're going to pay me decent for this. And so I'll do it. All right, fine, whatever. 2 weeks go by. I call back over to the place. His wife answers because they run the show together. And I said, hey, I take that back. He answered and I said, hey, what's going on, man? It's me. Is now a good time for me to come by and grab those pictures? And he's like, Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. That'll be, I said, great. I'll probably be there, you know, 3 o'clock this afternoon. He goes, okay, that works for me. I'll see you then. I go, oh, hey, how did it go at Area 51? He goes, I can't talk about that, click, and hangs up. And I was like, okay, well, that was weird. So then I show up there and I walk in, and that's when I see his wife. I go, what the fuck is going on? Well, I called him. I brought up the Area 51 thing and he hung up on me. And she goes, he's all freaked out. And I was like, why? She goes, he's all freaked out. He thinks this place is bugged. He thinks that people are listening to him. He's totally paranoid. And I was like, okay, this ought to be good. You know? So I go in there, I get the pictures and everything. And I go, what's going on? And he goes, we can't talk here. We got to go outside. And I was like, okay. So we go outside and go out around by the dumpster. And I go, please tell me what the fuck is happening here, because this is, you're freaking me out. He said, I saw something that I cannot even believe that I'm alive and allowed to leave this place. And I was like, okay, so what happened? He said, well, I was with him. They took me to a place. He said, they took me to Area 51. I go, well, how'd you know it was Area 51? He said, because I was told it was Area 51 when I was there, but, or S4 or whatever it was, or I don't know. But I go, so what did you do? He said, well, they took me into this hangar that was the biggest room I've ever seen in my entire life, bigger than anything you could possibly imagine. It's just giant. And it's like crammed into the side of a mountain or something. And there's like, the doors are to this hangar are open. And he said, they push this thing out. He goes, have you ever been to a carnival and seen those things that are like, it's three circles, and you as a person, you get in there and stand in there, and it starts to swing you around upside down, this way, that way. And, you know, it looks like a bad idea if you've been eating, you know, cotton candy all day. You don't want to get in. I go, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Like a gyroscope. He goes, yeah, exactly. It's like one of those. He said, so they have this thing that is like the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And he said, and they push it out, or they drive it out onto the tarmac out from this thing. And there's a guy on like a scissor lift with controls for it. And so I've got my camera and everything. And he said, the rules are that whenever I'm taking pictures, I have to, and this is 1995. So this is before the digital photography, because whenever I'm done with a roll of film, I hand the camera to the guard that's next to me. He opens it up, takes the roll of film out, loads up a new roll, and then hands me the camera back. So he says, at no time am I ever in possession of the film. He goes, so they start this, they push this thing out and they turn it on. And this gyroscope thing starts going around and around and around. Now, at the time he's telling me this story, the movie Contact hadn't come out yet. But now that I've seen it, I look back on it and it's similar. His description is similar to the Contact thing, where it's spinning around and spinning around. He says, so they start this thing up and it starts spinning, but it's not making any noise at all. And there's like a little pin on it, like a little arm on the top of it that's kind of holding it. You know, when it's not being used, it's kind of hold. And they get this thing spinning and then they release the pin and the arm comes down and it starts spinning and it starts to lift off the ground. I go, what did you do? He said, I was shitting myself when I saw, I've never seen anything quite like this, but I'm taking pictures and I'm handing, you know, as fast as I can, and we're switching out film and all this stuff. He says, and they take this thing up, and he goes, and I can tell it's spinning faster and faster, but I can't hear anything because it's not making any noise. And he said, and they get this thing way above us, you know, so I'm just, he's like, and all of a sudden it just disappears. It's just gone. It didn't fly anywhere. It just vanished. And he said, they said, look way down there. And then he could see, he looked way far away. And then they were telling him, start looking that direction. And he's looking that direction, and boom, all of a sudden it appears. And he says to me, he goes, And that was the moment that I thought I might not make it out of there alive. And I was like, what did you see? And he said, I don't know what I saw, but they called it the acorn. And that didn't mean anything to me until like maybe 15 years later, watching, you know, UFO videos and things like that. They talk about the Nazi bell, the Der Glocken, and that the nickname they had for that was the acorn. And I was like, holy shit, I think this guy saw the acorn. And the description that he gave of it, and this was, you know, this is 25 years ago, and it had, you know, there's no reason for him to lie to me. I wasn't writing books about that. I was bartending. I was, you know, he was just telling me the crazy story, plus his oversized paranoid reaction to it and his wife's annoyance with his paranoia from it. It just made the whole thing seem very real to me. And I've never had a UFO experience. I've never seen one. I've never seen anything like that. And this guy was, as you know, aside from the part where he was just a photographer being hired by the Air Force to take pictures of this, which rubbed both of us wrong from the beginning. Like, why would they do this?
Yeah.
That was the part of it that had me kind of going, why would they do this?
But unless they want him to tell people.
Unless they want him to tell people too. Right. That was the other thing, was it's like, unless they want him to tell people. So I've told that story to some people and they've said, well, maybe they wanted him to tell you about it. I go, well, maybe they wanted him to tell somebody about it, but there would be no reason to tell me about it. I wasn't writing books at this point. I was literally fresh out of college and I was bartending. I there's no reason to tell me to, again, I don't have a platform to get this out there, but like, you know, when you've got to go tell that story behind the dumpster outside of the place that where you work because you're convinced that they're listening to you, like, I don't know, man. He sold it pretty well. If he was lying, it was an elaborate lie that he sold very well. But I have a feeling that he was telling the truth about that. He didn't pretend to understand it. He didn't pretend to know where it came from. He never once called it alien. He just said it was technology that he could not explain. So I wonder how much of that technology we have access to.
I think we have considerable amounts. And you would imagine that the security at Area 51 would have upped its background check on people after Bob Lazar went public just 5 years previous to your friend getting the photography job.
Yep.
I suspect that they have done psychological profiles of anyone who comes and goes from Area 51 on a job or not, and that they understand that when you bring these people in, they are most likely to tell somebody. Mm-hmm. They probably know that this could be their long-term game plan of disclosure by gradually getting this out to the public one person at a time, and then over 10 years it spreads. But that's incredible. That's an incredible story. And yeah,
it didn't involve aliens. There were no green men. There was nothing. He didn't get taken down into some bunker where he saw where the alien, it was nothing like that. It was just, and it didn't connect. I mean, I thought it was a crazy story and I thought he was totally believable and all of that. But what cemented it for me was that was like 15 years later, watching a documentary on something and they're talking about the acorn and everything. And I go, oh, the acorn, holy shit. That's the name. And then you look at, and then it was the size, you know, he described it as the size of a Volkswagen bug, you know, and all this stuff. And I was like, God, that's what the Nazis were building. Did they have secret technology? Did they get instructions from something? Is there a Gartha? I mean, if the Nazi bell is real and it actually existed, then what about all this other crazy folklore that's tied to them about Antarctica bases and things like that? Like, who are we to say?
Where does it stop?
Where does it stop?
In 1965, there was a crash in Kecksburg. Mm-hmm. And that crash was in Pennsylvania, and the supposed UFO that crashed looked like an acorn.
Mm-hmm. The Kecksburg Bell.
Yeah, exactly. The Kecksburg Bell, the Kecksburg Acorn. The Army arrived and took it away.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of these little acorn things. But what he's talking about is like the gyros moving and teleportation
at
that point.
Yeah. 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 He said, and his response was, it was at that moment that I thought they weren't going to let me out of there alive. And cause he said the guy that was with me the whole time was totally nice, but he was also armed and sure. You know, and there,
he probably doesn't want to answer a lot of questions.
Yeah. 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 So, you know, so I should track him down and get him to see if he's willing to tell that story again, because it freaked me out. That was like my version of In Search Of, you know, it was my secondhand version of it, where I've got a guy telling me, like, I saw it with my own eyes and I was terrified, and not of there being aliens in it, but just that I knew too much was kind of his feeling on it. And, are they going to invite you there to show you that, then kill you because you saw it? Like that just seems kind of, he's like, I know, but like, you know, who knows what's going to happen. So I wonder about that. I wonder about, you know, we know, like, you and I have done lots of shows. We talk about government, you know, cover-ups and things that they're involved in. And we hear stories of the Smithsonian having giant bones, or have had giant bones that are hidden away somewhere else. And so I wonder, have you had anybody on or talked to anybody that has knowledge of the stories of giants and the bones of giants and how they, you know, I've seen the pictures and you know, yeah. And I don't believe any pictures now, because God knows they're so easy to manipulate. But have you come across any sort of stories or things like that about giants that stood out as being maybe true?
I haven't talked to anybody about giants, but I mean, I got a few books on them, and these supposedly that they're, like you said, the Smithsonian came by in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And any claim of giant bones, they kind of swept up and put away because it didn't really fit into academia at the time, especially if the scientific community was also headed up by Christians. They wanted to kind of scoot that away to forget about it, so we just could kind of move on with the world as they thought it should be. But there are stories of giants ranging from 7 feet up until like 18 feet. That have been buried next to each other, oftentimes with red hair. Yeah. It's like a race of giants with red hair, which is also interesting because a lot of Bigfoot sightings, they claim that these Bigfoots are actually red hair. Mm-hmm. Not that dissimilar. But then you also have cases and stories of giant skeletons being found in caves in Arizona. And sometimes those giant skeletons are found next to other skeletons that are much smaller. You could call them gnomes or elves or dwarves. Like there was a race of giants and a race of elves and dwarves. It's tough to get anybody in the modern scientific community to talk about that seriously. They're not going to. It'll be career suicide for them. But apparently there is evidence. There are article clippings from newspapers at the time. It was basically common knowledge at the time. Mm-hmm. But now you can't really get too much. The best you can do is getting newspaper clippings from the early 1900s.
That's crazy to me that it would be career suicide. I acknowledge that it would be, but it's weird that it is, because if you were, I mean, I would think if I were a scientist, my greatest accomplishment would be to discover something that nobody else had discovered, and that if that were a giant, let's say, that would be the crowning achievement of my career, would be to discover this giant, as opposed to this, well, oh, you know, there's only certain things you're allowed to discover, that we have to suppress. Yeah, I get it. It throws, you know, some aspects of like religious control into disarray. If you start, you know, we start talking about aliens or giants or things like that, it throws off this story of our past, you know, creates problems for us. So I can understand why some aspects of the church would want that suppressed, but who cares? What about the science? What about the scientific community? What about like a commitment to the truth?
No.
Is that asking too much?
No, it's only recently, you know, that even scientists dare entertain the idea of extrasolar life. Yeah, it's only been like within the past 3 years where it's been somewhat okay for physicists and scientists to entertain the idea that aliens may exist. Now it's you know, they speculated, oh, life's got to be out there. Now it's a little bit more accepted that you could entertain the idea that they may be here. Mm-hmm. I mean, a New York Post article came out recently with a physicist saying that that object that passed through our solar system in 2017, it's his scientific opinion that it was a piece of alien technology because of the way it accelerated after getting past its apex in orbit. And that's a controversial opinion, but he put his name and his career on the line. And God bless him for doing that finally. But it's just acceptable now to do that.
Yeah. That was the cigar-shaped Oumuamua.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was fascinating. I mean, that was interesting. And of course, you know, these days, who knows what's the truth? I mean, if it's allowed to go out into the mainstream media, then it's like, well, you almost have to question that, why it was allowed to do that. But I remember reading that as well and being like, whoa, this is not what I, you know, it's oblong. It's an interesting shape. And they talked about it picking up speed at a certain, you know, at a certain distance. So it's very, very strange. I wonder, what about a blending of cryptids and UFOs together into Men in Black? What do we think about Men in Black?
So what's weird is like, it's almost like you can't have one without the other to a certain degree. When I'm talking about UFOs and cryptids, because oftentimes UFO hotspots are also cryptid hotspots, specifically Bigfoot and like larger kind of cryptids. Like, in the 1960s, like Stan Gordon covered that pretty well in Silent Invasion, where you would have like a wave of either UFO or Bigfoot sightings. And then over the next week, the opposite would follow. And then you would oftentimes have a combination. I mean, there is a person on record that says, I saw two large creatures by my fence. I cracked a few shots at them with my rifle. They looked at me. The bullets either didn't hurt them or passed right through them. Then they went into a clearing, got into a glowing red orb, and took off. So that's a UFO. That's some sort of crypto creature. You could say Bigfoot or who knows. But they seem to go hand in hand. Not dissimilar. Oftentimes, like the dwarves I researched throughout history, a lot of times people, yeah, they saw them in uniforms, but there's also stories of those little dwarven creatures. I'm talking not talking about like someone who's short, but people who said, yeah, they had beards and they looked like a dwarf and they got out of a silver craft. Right. This bizarre stuff. But for Men in Black, you know, I that is a subject that is, it is tough to pin down and is also controversial. People think that it's, oh, it's the Air Force and their particular intelligence division to ensure that whatever technology they're working on is not being talked about too much. And then there's people who think that they're aliens and they're here to clamp down on people to make sure that the alien presence is not talked about. And some people think they're demons or from the astral realm here to just kind of be minders of what we do and don't talk about. It's crazy.
It is crazy. The stories of them showing up, or I've seen some video where it looks like these two guys. Well, I mean, you never know who's making this up, but then Hollywood doing the Hollywood thing and putting it out front and showing Men in Black in movies with Will Smith and then being like, hey, isn't this funny? So like, you can almost feel the disinformation game kicking in with that, where it's like, hey, let's make it, you know, comical and main, so mainstream that it's, you know, that it can't possibly exist. It's too preposterous as a cover for it actually happening. You know, I could certainly see that being part of the, play. What about, well, let's just do it since we're on Iconic here, among other platforms. What about reptilians? I mean, you and I are both Howard Stern fans. I don't know if you've heard it, but I heard the interview with Billy Corgan on Howard Stern talking about his encounter at a cocktail party where he saw a guy shapeshift into a reptilian and back. And his response to Howard when pressed for it was, I saw something I cannot explain. And he was as serious and as you know, as matter of fact about it as you can be. And is there just a point at which there's so much talk about it that it can't be about nothing? Like, there has to be some sort of fire with all this smoke.
I would say so. I have that clip if you want me to play it.
Please.
Let's play this. This is Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins on Howard Stern talking about his shapeshifter experience.
The Howard Stern Show.
What happened? Give me a for instance. I want
to
know.
I'm turning red and so embarrassed.
No, don't be embarrassed. Come on. Share. Why not? We have to discuss
Let's just say I was with somebody once and I saw a transformation that I can't explain.
The person transformed into something other than human.
Yes, I saw it.
Were you on drugs?
I was not. It was totally sober.
Wow.
I'm asking you some questions. If you were talking to someone,
yes,
and you're having a conversation,
yes,
like we are now,
yeah,
this close, and the person suddenly, not in a hallucination, they said to you, look, something's going to happen here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to morph into something else. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this is ridiculous.
That's not how it happened.
give me a, please. I want to see this.
Imagine you're doing something and suddenly you turn around and there's somebody else standing there.
A different human.
Sort of. It's hard to explain without going to detail. I'd rather not go into details.
But did you say to the person, what'd you just do here?
That's yes, and they acknowledged it.
And what did they say they were? From another planet?
They wouldn't explain.
Why not?
Again, without telling the story, it's a really messed up story.
A famous person?
No.
Good.
Why is that not famous?
By the way,
why is that good?
Why don't you put them on wrestling?
Believe it or not, they're actually a voting member of the Rock and Roll Academy.
Is that true?
I'm just
It's Jan Winner, isn't it?
But when you say they transformed into someone else or something,
I mean, Billy,
else,
I've had that happen.
I'm being vague on purpose.
I was with a woman once. She took her makeup off. I didn't know who the fuck she was. I'm telling you, she totally tricked me. You talk about something like that, that's a different story. Wow. I mean,
it's up there with one of the most intense things I've ever been through.
The Howard Stern Show.
Maybe he was doing it for publicity. I don't know. I believe him. I
believe him too. Billy Corgan, though I don't know him, doesn't strike me as the hyperbolic type. I mean, he seems very measured and almost didn't sound like he wanted to tell the story. But no. You know, Howard has a way of dragging it out of, so he gave sort of a edited version of it. I mean, David Icke has talked about this, how he was in a makeup chair at the BBC years and years ago, getting ready to go on, and Ted Heath was in the makeup chair next to him, and Ted Heath looked him up and down, like looked at his feet, and then like looked all the way up his body. And when he looked at Ted Heath's eyes, he said his eyeballs were everything was just black. It was like he wasn't himself. It was like there was something possessing him. All of these stories, I'm not there. Yeah. I can't confirm any of it. So, and that, of course, is the easiest way to deflect, to create doubt, to marginalize these people, is the fact that it happens, you know, in a way where the spaceship is not landing on the lawn of the White House. This is happening in obscure places or to individuals. And when you tell that story, you wish you had a judge, you know, like, oh, I was at a judge's convention and I was with six judges that were sitting behind me and we all saw it. That never happens like that. It always happens when you're by yourself or with maybe with somebody else, or they knock you out and you're trying to piece it all back together. I understand why people don't want to talk about this stuff, because it's hard to talk about it and not sound crazy. And people value their credibility, as they should. They have jobs that maybe depend on that. They have a reputation. They don't want to look lesser than in front of their friends and family. They don't want to be picked on. I mean, if any of my friends told one of these stories, we would relentlessly fuck with them for the rest of their lives. I mean, it is not the sort of, I mean, in a funny way, not in a,
sure, you got to do it.
You got to do it. But it would be, we would find a way to turn it into a joke, when in actuality, man, I tell you, Billy Corgan didn't sound like he was having much fun telling, I mean, he was sort of messing around with Howard, kind of give it back. But that sends them. If that's a real story and that really happened and you really see that, what does that do to you? What does that do to you for the rest of your life when you now know with 100% certainty in your soul that something like that is out there and possible? How do you go through life after that?
Probably a little bit more difficult. And these kinds of stories is what is going to make full alien disclosure that much more difficult. Like, we'll probably get some stuff here and there, but how is, like, when the report is released in 180 days, and let's say that it acknowledges off-world technology in some fashion, they're not going to talk about that crazy object that your friend saw at Area 51. Mm-mm. Like, we are in possession of teleportation technology. How full of a disclosure will it be? We'll probably go like a small little sliver. And then how do you account for a lot of eyewitness testimony? Barney and Betty Hill, the dwarves in Germany I talked about, the Ukrainian dwarves who come down in saucers. There's a lot of explaining to do, and I doubt we're going to be getting that explaining. When it comes to shape-shifting reptiles, I mean, God, it's almost like they've been training, getting us used to that kind of concept for a long time when it comes to the miniseries V in the early mid-80s. I love that series. Or They Live. I mean, it's a distinct possibility. I mean, geez, David Icke talks about that all the time.
Yeah. So much to talk about, so much to do, so much to geek out on. I could talk about this stuff forever. That's Midnight Mike, everybody. You got to go check out OBDM, Our Big Dumb Mouth, and the Union of the Unwanted. Mike, where can people find you? When can people find the show? When can people tune in for the live shows?
Oh, boy. If you want to tune into the live shows, you can go to search for OBDM videos on YouTube. We're live 7 p.m. on Wednesdays and noon on Saturdays, or you can just download the podcast a little bit later. Just go to obdmpod.com. Just we're on Stitcher, iTunes, and Spotify, all that kind of stuff. I will warn people, it takes like one or two episodes to get into because we like to goof around quite a bit, but we are a call-in show and we like to listen to everyone and everyone's opinion. So you're welcome.
Your description of it being like a combination of like Coast to Coast and Howard Stern and all that, It's so right. You've got, you know, Cretchit, who is the equivalent of Fred, mm-hmm. You know, coming in, and you and Joe are phenomenal. I just love the dynamics. I love it. It's my brand of humor. It's not for everybody, but for those that know it and those that get it, boy, it's an addiction. Thanks, Mike, for being on. I appreciate it. And I'll see you next time around for the Union of the Unwanted. And hey, everybody, if you like this show and you think your friends might like it or geek out on it, please share it. If you're listening to this on a podcast player, there's a little button somewhere on there that says share. So that's the only way it's going to happen for us, is if you get out there and share it and game the system, because the algorithms, they don't like us. They don't like us very much. And the feeling is mutual. Thanks, everybody. Take care.